But we begin our program this evening with Ari Palm, a New York City-based journalist who's covered politics for The Nation, Vice, The Guardian, Dissent, Jacobin, Al Jazeera America, and many other publications. I'm so glad you could join us this evening, Ari. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
I invited you initially here to discuss your recent article titled "The F Word." Yes, Donald Trump is a fascist, and that matters, which was recently published on the TELUSRTV.net website. And, Ari, of course, since we planned our interview, we had the death of the Supreme Court's longest-serving and conservative justice, Antonin Scalia, over the weekend. And now we're seeing a political battle develop over when a nominee to replace him will get a vote in the U.S. Senate. And that battle, of course, has already begun, at least rhetorically. GOP Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has said he will wait until after the November 2016 election to take up any nomination, where President Obama has pledged to nominate a replacement soon. So this thing is stacking up as an important battle and an important issue in the 2016 election. Ari, maybe as we begin here, and we'll get to Donald Trump and the article you wrote about him recently, but I first wanted maybe for you to review for our audience a little bit about the important history of Antonin Scalia.
Well, obviously, Scalia is going to go down as sort of one of the most famous conservative jurists of all time in U.S. history, in part not because of his ideology, but because of his writing style, his ability to sort of so emotionally and caustically go after his ideological opponents on the left on issues of abortion rights, equal rights for gays, gun rights, the issues of crime and criminal justice in terms of the death penalty, a very big advocate for the death penalty. He's always going to be sort of a symbol for that kind of conservatism that sort of sometimes conservatives feel like they're on the defensive. They've lost a lot of the culture wars. They lost the battle over gay marriage, and they seem to not make a lot of progress overturning Roe versus Wade. So he sort of symbolizes that long fight in the judicial realm for the cultural right.
Thanks for that rundown, Ari. Now, when it comes to the pending cases now before the Supreme Court, and what will happen to those cases, given the fact that with only eight justices currently on the court, there's the potential for tie votes, and with a very kind of delicate balance on the court, it's likely there would be some important tie votes in these pending cases. I've read about a few of them, but maybe if you'd like, you can run down a few of those cases and what might happen to those rulings given the death of Scalia.
Yeah, well, one of the biggest ones, of course, is the recently argued Fredericks versus CTA, which is a case that would have very much affected all public sector unions in the United States. The case would have imposed a right-to-work regime over all public sector unions. That would mean that anyone who does not want to join the union in a certain workplace that is unionized would not have to pay dues. Currently, those people who don't want to join a union have to pay what's called an agency shop fee that covers the collective bargaining rights and all the benefits that they get along with union representation. This would sort of allow people to opt out in a workplace that would very much cripple a lot of public sector unions, especially teacher unions, because this is the members' dues money is how these unions operate. So if they lose even 20-30% of their membership dues, this very much means layoffs. It's very difficult for them to operate. This was argued in January. It had unionists extremely nervous because they knew that it would be a close vote. And in fact, the two conservative jurists that were thought to possibly swing in favor of organized labor were Justices Kennedy and Scalia. Scalia being the closest to Justice Rehnquist on some of these issues, and Rehnquist actually had voted with organized labor in the original precedent 40 years ago. So there was some hope going into that case that Scalia would save the day for labor, but at the hearings it was very clear to everybody that all five conservative justices were buying the anti-union argument being presented there, and most unions were preparing for a new right-to-work regime coming in June. Now, with the death of Scalia, that leaves everything at about a 4-4, and this kicks the case back down to the original Ninth Circuit decision, which upheld the current union dues regime. Now, that kind of gives labor a reprieve for a while. It's not exactly a victory. This would mean that either the case would have to be heard before the full court in the next term. So this could kick the can to possibly 2017. The more likely situation is that the anti-union organizations that have backed these right-to-work lawsuits will simply find another test case and present it, and they'll have another chance. Now, we don't know who's going to replace Scalia, so that totally, you know, remakes the landscape, but it's definitely a reprieve for labor. And on a number of other issues, especially the case out of Texas with affirmative action, there was a fear that among some people that there would be a 5-4 decision over striking down the ability to use any kind of race-based affirmative action in admissions in higher education. That's also thrown to the wind. There's a lot of cases, but those are sort of the big ones that that have been cited in the news.
One of the cases that I've been reading about is the redistricting case, where conservative forces are trying to contend that only voters should be counted in congressional districts when it comes to designing and mapping out new congressional district maps. And of course, that would negate counting underage citizens, non-citizens, and others who don't have the right to vote, prisoners as well, of course. What's the import of that case, do you think?
Well, you know, this really is a part of the almost sort of half-century-long battle that the political right has waged through the judicial realm to undo a lot of the progress of the 1960s and 1970s. If you read Jeffrey Toobin's book about called The Nine about the Supreme Court, it actually lays it out fairly well. And Scalia was very much part of this sort of multi-decade-long movement to undo a lot of the legal progress, and part of that is the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act. So he was very much a part of these cases that would have the court say, well, these things were necessary in a time of social upheaval, in a time of transition, but they don't fit for 2016. We've made a lot of progress since then. It's time to undo these things. And of course, people on the civil rights end of things would argue, you know, the opposite, that of course it's not 50 years ago, but there are new problems and new issues, and things need to have oversight. So that's very much something that's going to be a key, talking point as is the question of who replaces Scalia goes forward, because that really is what's at stake for the right now. They've enjoyed a 5-4 kind of block to advance these things ever since the George W. Bush administration, when O'Connor, who is considered more of a centrist, left. So, you know, this really throws their project into the gears.
Yep. And one comment I just wanted to go over here that our listeners may have heard of, and that was in ruling in the court case that really gutted the Voting Rights Act a couple of years ago, Justice Scalia basically said that the Supreme Court had to rescue Congress because they would be hesitant to vote against the Voting Rights Act in the legislative branch. But he said really that he was willing to overturn that, at least that one element of the Voting Rights Act, because he viewed it as a racial entitlement, meaning so somehow it was unjustified that African Americans and other minorities should be guaranteed a vote, which I took when I first heard it, when the case was being discussed in the media, as a completely odious statement, blatantly racist, and along with some other things he said.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and yet he maintains maintained in past tense, I should say, such a close relationship with it's the only black justice on the on the Supreme Court. It's kind of it seems sort of strange considering many of the opinions that he's put forth, including the one you just quoted. You know, it's interesting the way he talked about rescuing Congress, because the original sort of conservative view of the court, the conservative with a lowercase c philosophically, was the idea that the Supreme Court should be a very almost restrained body. This idea that it would have to overtake other aspects of government was almost anathema to the so-called originalist and textualist view of the of how the court should operate itself. So it's very interesting that the conservative wing, its sort of most celebrated justice, sort of almost takes the, to use their own language of what they say about liberal justices, an activist judge, is that he needs the court, he needs to use the court to invade upon the other aspects of the U.S. government to ensure that, you know, they don't get too liberal, they don't start addressing issues of civil rights and racial equality, so that he actually turns it on its head. He makes it a more activist vehicle than in reality conservative justice should want it to be.
And maybe you could explore one other comment before we move on to Donald Trump. And that was a comment made by Justice Scalia in another case where he's talking about how blacks in this country would not benefit from placement in prestigious universities, but would be better placed in slower track institutions. Another example of what I think can only be classified as blatant racism.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when he died, there was sort of a feeling amongst a lot of people of, oh, was he even that old? Was he ill? I mean, perhaps this, you know, I haven't seen the man's medical record, but it's quite possible that this was a man, you know, towards the end of his life where he sort of felt, I can just about say anything I want at this point. You know, who's going to stop me? I mean, look, a Supreme Court justice has an appointment for life. They can't be voted out. This person's not going to go on to another job anytime, you know, ever. They, you know, they enjoy a great degree of freedom to say exactly what's on their mind. And, you know, there's almost a small part where you have to admire the, you know, the ability to just get up there and say those things because he knows he has no consequence. There's no consequences for him. But as you say, it does sort of, you know, really show the dark heart of that part of the conservative movement, that this was their hero, this was their activist judge, and that he was so willing to, you know, basically say something that, you know, the average person interprets as, you know, blatantly racist.
Well, that leads naturally to our next topic for discussion tonight. I should reintroduce you. We're speaking with Ari Paul, New York City-based journalist who's covered politics for many national publications and international publications. We'll be discussing here towards the end of our talk this evening Ari's recent article titled "The F-Word: Yes, Donald Trump is a Fascist, and That Matters." Well, Ari, I wonder, as you dissected a lot of the discussion and debate about what kind of political current Donald Trump represents, you come out on the side of saying, yes, Donald Trump is a fascist, as indicated in the title of that piece.
Yeah, I mean, let's start off with remembering that there are a lot of people in the U.S. political commentary at that get very wary of throwing that word around, and for good reason. It does get thrown around a lot to sort of mean some, you know, someone who is just very right wing, and that is very inaccurate. And I think there's a feeling that if you use it too much, you discredit yourself and you discredit the word. But I think with Trump, and you really saw it, you know, at the very beginning when he jumped in the race, when people, you know, at that point considered him a joke and someone not to last very long, that he existed sort of to the economic left of all the other Republicans in the race. They want to reduce the federal government. They want to defer power to the states. They want to defer power to corporations. They don't want any kind of strong state central apparatus. And they, you know, attack things, you know, that they would call entitlement, Social Security, Medicare, social, you know, subsidies for, you know, for industry in the United States. He sort of had nothing to do with that. He left that untouched, and in many cases sort of said that he wanted to preserve it. He talks about undoing NAFTA, bringing back, you know, manufacturing jobs back to the United States. Sort of a protectionist argument that you don't hear on the right very much because it's so out of whack with with the corporate sector. But it sort of comes also with this sort of almost one issue anger towards. Well, at first it was Mexican undocumented immigrants wanting to build a wall, and so he used sort of that scapegoat that moved to Muslims he's going to block all Muslims into the United States, and this has sort of now gone into a whole other area of really just sort of unabashed white nationalism. Just anyone who's not a part of the white mainstream becomes the reason for why Social Security might be in trouble, why we don't have health care. It's not, oh, we have to privatize these things. We can, the state can, have a strong central support for all these programs, but it's going to be at the expense of these scapegoats. And that is more in line with the fascistic line of thinking or the fascistic tradition. Now, I don't think a lot of people who are wearing Donald Trump pins and planning on voting for him or who already have voted for him, think of themselves as fascists, but they are definitely hearing and parroting that kind of rhetoric, which has usually been absent, or at least only on the fringes of the political landscape.
Yeah, and you point out in the article that Donald Trump has attracted support from white supremacist groups and individuals, and has he disavowed any of that support publicly?
I know he has said, when David Duke first started commenting about him, he said, oh, I don't want David Duke's support. There was an incident in, I believe it was Boston, in which two Donald Trump supporters beat up, I can't remember if he was a South Asian or a black person, but they yelled some racist comment as they assaulted this person and mentioned Donald Trump's name. And of course, Donald Trump said, I denounce this and I want nothing to do with that. And that kind of sort of, whether or not he actually believes that, I kind of think is irrelevant, in part because the cat's out of the bag. At this point, it doesn't matter whether or not he disavows it or avows it. The elements who believe this and want to act upon it have been in power. They've been brought out of the fringes. They're now in the mainstream. And so whether or not he disavows it, if he drops out of the race, if he doesn't win, the damage is done well past 2016. This is now a political movement that's mobilized and has an ideology, and you have the fringes sort of seeing their entrance point to get back into the game. I think it's less about him, the individual, and what he says, and more about the monster that he's created.
Yeah, I want to, as we conclude here, Ari, I just wanted to explore that point with you. As you said, Trump and his very noxious rhetoric has erased for many the stigma of espousing blatant racist and Islamophobic sentiment. And I'm wondering if you think Trumpism, if we can call it that, will outlast the 2016 election cycle. I mean, do you see the formation of some kind of new current within the Republican Party that will follow Trump's lead to say we need to be more upfront about our racist views?
I think that might happen in part because the Republican establishment has been so shaken by this. There have been numerous reports that the Republican establishment is sort of running around in a chaotic fashion, trying to stamp out this fire. They like the idea that the extremists get out there and rile up the base, but they want an establishment candidate, and now they have something that's out of their control. So if they try to use political maneuvering to get rid of him, to have a contested election in which they force him out, I doubt he'll run as a third party because I don't think he wants to help the Democrats that much. But it will create, sort of much like the Tea Party, almost another radical current within the Republicans. I mean, sort of as an aside, I sometimes think that the U.S. government would almost be better served if we, instead of having two parties, we recognize that we almost have five parties: a progressive wing of the Democratic Party, which would be one party, the establishments of the Democratic and Republican parties, which would be a sort of corporate, pro-business, pro-military, state-centered moderate party, and then you would have the various factions of the Republicans, one being the Tea Party, but the Tea Party is now very different from Trump, that Trump represents something very different. And as I say, historically connected to more fascistic movements.
Yeah, sort of like what we have in Europe with the National Front and the mainstream conservative parties and the socialist parties and the Green parties and all manner of parties in places like Germany and France and Britain. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say that it's important to recognize that those parties, those far-right parties in Europe, do use the populist language of the left to try to get people to come to their side, and they only succeed when there aren't strong lefts. So that the National Front can attack austerity at one point, but it can also blame it on Islamic immigration on the other.
And you say in this article, which is an important point to leave our discussion on, that you feel whatever chord Donald Trump has struck in people with his his extreme right rhetoric and economic populism, that the most effective way to counter that is an anti-austerity movement in the country that can attract those people who've lost jobs, see their economic future as pretty dismal, and don't see any help on the way from either Republicans or Democrats. So you think a progressive anti-austerity movement really could have wider appeal if it really gets out there and shakes the trees?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I hope. I mean, I think we're seeing some of that that energy with the candidacy of Bernie Sanders. But we don't know what's going to happen to him and on the Democratic side of things. So it means that people who are upset about austerity, who are not Trumpists, if we're going to coin that term tonight, continue that energy beyond these primaries and beyond 2016.
Well, we're just about out of time. Ari, I want to thank you so much for spending time with us tonight talking about the death of Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia and your recent article titled The F Word. Yes, Donald Trump is a fascist, and that matters. Ari, is there a place our listeners can find your recent articles? I've been impressed with a lot of the things you've written here that our people should hear.
There's not one website just yet, but if you Google my name, Ari Paul, you will definitely see the different publications come right up.
Well, I'm glad we got to talk tonight, and I'll look forward to staying in touch so we can have you back about the things you're writing. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it, Ari. Good night. That's Ari Paul, New York City-based journalist, and has covered politics for many publications, including The Nation magazine, Vice, The Guardian, Dissent, Jacobin, Al Jazeera America, and many others, talking about both the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia and Donald Trump, and the article Ari had written about Donald Trump and fascism, the F-word.